Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And a beautiful Shabbat it is. I want to talk with you a little more about Balak in the next little while. Now, in the Parsha, as Rabbi Nathan mentioned, what we have is a tough situation for the local people on the other side of the Jordan. And the situation was this: Israel is about to cross into the Promised Land. We were in proximity of some of the local people. One of the areas there was Balak's area. The Moabites lived there. Other peoples lived there. So he pays a professional prophet to come and curse Israel. And initially, Balaam doesn't want to come, but he sends a bigger honorarium, and so he says, "Okay, I'll come, and I want you to curse Israel." And we need to keep in mind that back then they understood something, that blessings and cursings are real things. Did you know that? There's something to it. We live in a very psychologized world. We live in a materialistic, philosophical world. And we don't tend to think about these things, but there is a certain materiality to words, and blessings and cursings can have a real impact. And it's for another sermon, but that's the mechanism. That's what's going on. And so Balaam is commissioned to curse Israel. So Balak says, "Look, go on top of the mountain, you'll see them." And there we were, stretched across a wide panorama. He goes up there, and here's what he says. Here is what he says. Balaam spoke his message, or his first oracle. "Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come," he said, "curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel." "How can I curse those whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom the Lord has not denounced? From the rocky peaks I see them. From the heights I view them. I see a people who live apart and who do not consider themselves one of the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number even a fourth of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and may my final end be like theirs." He comes down, and Balak says to him, "What are you doing? I asked you to curse them, and you bless them. Try again. Stand in a different place. Have lunch first. And then your blood sugar will be better, and you'll be able to do what I asked you to do." So there's another oracle. Here's a portion from the third of his oracles. "When Balaam looked out and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came on him, and he spoke this message: the prophecy of Balaam, son of Beor, the prophecy of one whose eye sees clearly, the prophecy of one who hears the words of God, who sees a vision for the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes have opened. How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel." Does that sound at all familiar? How do we start our service today? Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov mishkenotecha Yisrael. Did you know that you were quoting this prophet who was commissioned to curse Israel, and this is what comes out? Yeah, we say it every week. Now, there's a big point that I want to make here, and that is that Israel is a very, very special nation, the Jewish people, a very, very special people. We love the United States, and there are some people who use quasi-theological language to talk about God's blessings in the United States. Let me just say that's easily overdone. Israel is a category by its own. It is not like any other country. We are a covenanted people. We are part of a covenanted people, speaking both of the geography of Israel, of course, but also of the peoplehood. And I should say, and this is a very important point, and a big mistake that some people make, they tend to think of just Israel in terms of lofty spiritual ideas. It's all spiritual. But actually, the physicality of Israel is very, very important. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were real people who had real kids, and they passed on that identity by virtue of physical descent. Now, it's possible to so emphasize physical descent that the spiritual dimension is lost. And Yochanan HaMadbil, John the Immerser, spoke to that. And Yeshua speaks to that too. But let's not go to the other extreme. Physical descent is very, very important. Are we all on the same page on that? It really is quite important, and the implications are so staggeringly important and far-reaching. I'll just wanted to touch on it now. But let me talk about the challenge we face. You see, as we think of Balaam looking out over Israel, and he's looking from a distance. He's got a distant view, and he gives his prophecy. But I think if we got close and walked among the tribes, we would find that we're not always so great. In fact, we're a lot like other people. This kind of chosenness that we have doesn't have to do primarily with us being so great. As a matter of fact, I think you'd walk by some tents and hear people screaming at each other, and you'd have teenagers picking on other kids, and you would have all the social problems that every other people have, maybe to a lesser degree because of the giving of the Torah as it takes hold, but nonetheless, we don't want to idealize ourselves in terms of in those terms. And we have problems that we need to face. I want to articulate one for you that's a big one, and one that we need to think about as a Messianic Jewish community. And here it is. Now, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about, and then I'll make the point. There is a famous conservative synagogue in the Boston area called Mishkan Tefillah. Have you heard of it before? Mishkan Tefillah. It is the oldest conservative synagogue in New England, and it has up until now, it's just been sold, a magnificent campus in Chestnut Hill, near the Chestnut Hill Mall there. And they went, in a 10-year period, from 900 families to 200, and they felt it necessary to sell that beautiful property, and now they don't know what exactly they're doing. They're meeting in another synagogue temporarily. And that story of large synagogues disintegrating, if you will, is not uncommon. There's another Reform synagogue I'd learned about in Columbus, Ohio, which was the absolute flagship for Reform Judaism in Columbus, and it just folded. And about 2 weeks ago, I went back to my alma mater, Hebrew College, where I got some of my training, and that's in Newton. And I walked in, and the halls are empty. And I went to my friends, the librarians, these two guys, I've known them for forever. I said, Robert, Harvey, what's going on here? And they said, well, the school has struggled so much since the 2008 economic downturn. Remember that? How could you forget, right? The school lost so many major donors during that time and through the Bernie Madoff incident as well. Not that the school had invested with Bernie, but some of their major donors had, that they took such a hit financially that the place felt like a ghost town. I mean, when I was there, there were people and classes and things were exciting, and it's a school that goes back to the 19th century, and now you have this, and it's practically empty, and they've gone just strictly, the rabbinical school is flourishing, doing well, but they almost lost their facility, and there's very few people there. They've got some online courses now, which are cheaper. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that being Israel and sustaining Israel is not an easy thing to do. And yet, what Balaam said is true. In the God of the universe's way of doing things, there were things, if I were God, I might not do it the same way. But this is how he works. He chooses to mediate his blessings to all the boys and girls in the world, all the people, through this unique chosen people, the Jewish people, Israel. It's just what he has chosen to do. And, of course, through Yeshua, by extension, we have the nations of the world connected to Israel, the historic church. But that's another story. But the point I'm trying to make is we have this unique relationship, and yet the journey is difficult. The journey is filled with these disappointments, challenges. Now, let me give you one that's a little bit closer to home, and this is something that some of us here think an awful lot about, and that is there has been a change in the character of the Messianic Jewish movement over the past 40 years that we've been involved, and that is that, and it largely has to do with numbers. I think it has to do with, there's a few factors, but one is just the relative numbers, that the relative number of Jewish people in Messianic Jewish synagogues has gone down and non-Jews has gone up. And that is of real concern, not because of anything anti-non-Jew, Christian, anything like that, certainly not. It has to do with the very nature of a Messianic Jewish synagogue. And I need to speak with you about this just for a few minutes. You see, we're a confusing place to be because the question, the unarticulated, often unarticulated question is, well, are you a Jewish church or are you a synagogue? You know what I'm saying? And that's kind of confusing for people, understandably. Are you, you know, you have churches that are Italian and they have Italian culture and they'll sing the ba-dum, 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 or whatever they, you know what I mean? And you have Eskimo congregations and they are partial to big coats with furry and maybe they meet in igloos, I don't know. But your point is you have different, aren't you, have French churches and you have different ethnic communities, and so is Messianic Judaism just another ethnic community? Or is a Messianic Jewish synagogue a synagogue, thereby making it or claiming to be a little piece of the Jewish people first and foremost? You see the distinction? It's a very, very subtle but important distinction. You see? Now, the way Ruach has always functioned, since we came in 1981, is that we have understood ourselves to be a synagogue. That is, we are a little piece of Am Yisrael here in Needham, Massachusetts. And part of the reason that that has been a point of passion for us is we have felt, and I think rightly, that to put on talluses and wear yarmulkes and have Torah scrolls and bar and bat mitzvahs, if we are not a little piece of Israel, but just a Jewish-style church, there is something inauthentic about that. You see, these are the religious symbols of Israel. These are the things that bespeak the ongoing history of a people who have somehow made it despite the challenges through inquisitions and holocausts and dispersions, and here we are. And so these symbols and these ways, these modes of communicating who we are to ourselves and to the following generations only becomes authentic if our claim, if our doing things, these things, fits our claim. It is not just cultural affectation. It's not just that we like bagels and Greeks like baklava. That is not it. Although I happen to like baklava a lot too, you know, and I happen to like bagels even more. But that's not the point. Am I being clear or completely obtuse here? Because this stuff is subtle. It really, really is. And so it leaves us with something of a dilemma. Remember what Balaam said, I see a people who are apart, who do not consider themselves one of the nations, who can count the dust of Jacob or number even a fourth of Israel. Let me die the death of the righteous, and may we find my end like theirs. And the issue is an important one for us. It is a matter of authenticity. It is a matter of your kids growing up. And when they're little, it doesn't matter. But once they get to be 15, 16, they see glaring inconsistencies among their parents. Isn't that true? Kids are smart. I mean, they really are. And if they sense that really what they've been doing is playing a game and there's no rootage in historical peoplehood, but all this stuff is just a matter of, just culture, then why should they hold on to it? You see, there's no reason. There's no reason. But when they know that you are part of a unique people and God has commanded us to do certain things so that we can sustain ourselves in a world that says, forget about it, and that world is that's the world of that we live in, which trivializes any kind of claim to specialness or particularity, why should they and why will they continue? It's hard enough. Anyhow, so, but the challenge we face, again, is that the Messianic Jewish movement, some congregations are 80% non-Jewish people. And the point is, you can't have a synagogue without Jews. You just can't. You can't have a synagogue predominantly among people whose earliest memories are not Passover Seders and the other dimensions. You just can't. It's unsustainable, absolutely unsustainable. But, it's understandable too. You have 60 million evangelical people in the United States, a growing segment of those folks, those wonderful folks, and some of you are here today. You just love, you know, there's not an anti-Semitic bone in your body. You just like all this stuff, and I understand that. What you have 13.5 million Jewish people in the world, 6 million in the United States, that's a tiny fraction, and so it's a numbers thing. And it frankly is just easier. It is just easier for a Christian to travel the emotional distance to showing up at Jewish services than it is for a Jew to travel the emotional distance of embracing the one who indirectly was viewed as the source of our suffering for so many centuries. You see what I mean? So these are the realities, and I'm talking to you very straight today, but I felt I needed to. Okay, so basically, we're facing the same problem that lots of people face. Let me just give you one quick example from Susan, my trip. So we spent the day at Yosemite Park. Have you ever been to Yosemite? It's gorgeous. It is so beautiful. You got to go. We were just there for one day. Well, we took a tour, and we're in this bus, and the guide is telling us about this waterfall and this rock formation and El Capitan, which you can barely see the top of, and you see I can't see them, but you could see little teeny people climbing up the rock face. I think they should take up Parcheesi or chess or something else, but that's what they want to do. But that's what they want to do. But, you know, the guide at the end of the tour was giving us the same kind of exhortation or kind of articulating the challenge he was facing. He said, you know, in the 1960s, 2 million people a year visited the park. But this year, 5 million are expected. There's a 30% increase in the number of cars recently. And a quote, sometimes the smog over Yosemite Valley is so thick you can't see it from the air, you know? And he sees this, he's been there for, working there for 20-something years, and he loves Yosemite. And he's seeing that, you know, people come and visit and they don't sense the difficulty. But what's the difficulty? Too many cars, too many people coming in. And so he feels, you know, he and others feel stuck. And what they've done some things. For example, they've gotten rid of some of the parking lots, and so grass has grown up, and that's improved a bit. But that's just a drop in a bucket. Now, his problem is going to be solved through government action, and there are groups on opposite sides. There are industrial interests and other people who want to see the park up open all the time, and there are others who sense the ecological issues that he was facing, and they'll work that out. But I want to give us, rather than solve an issue, I want to give us a means whereby we can think as a community about the issue that I raised that we face. And let me just say parenthetically, lest any of you feel we have some non-Jewish folks who've been with us for years, thank God for the Christian people who have helped Ruach Israel over the years. If it wasn't for some of our Christian friends, I wonder if we'd be here. You know what I mean? And I just want to add a special note of deep appreciation for spouses, non-Jewish spouses, who, in an attempt to help their Jewish husbands or wives come, they've come and been an incredibly important part. And Ruach, by design, has always been a place for Jewish and intermarried families in hopes that those families would develop a Jewish lifestyle, way of being, sense of Torah, and all. But boy, what credit you deserve. And I say it with the utmost respect and great, great love. The dilemma, of course, is how do you, on the one hand, honor Yeshua's command that we love one another. Remember that command? It's very much part of the whole Besorah portion we read this morning. How do you, on the one hand, have that operating? Because without it, how could you claim to be a follower of Yeshua? And on the other hand, how do we guard the particularism? How do we guard the uniqueness of a synagogue where we see the trajectory in so many of our sister synagogues that they're not willing to take some tough steps, perhaps, or whatever it is that needs to be done? And the net result is project over another 20 or 30 years. You can think about Yosemite, you can think about Messianic Judaism. Will it legitimately be a Jewish expression, or will it lose its essential character? Now, here's how the problem has to be solved. The problem has to be solved, and I'm not going to get into specifics. We're working on the specifics. I'm thinking about them. Rabbi Nathan's thinking about them. We're thinking about them. But here's the paradigm. We, as followers of the risen one, are called to enter into his experience and thereby gain his heart and his mind. You follow what I'm saying? He wants us to become little Yeshuas, in a sense. And corporately, as a community, no matter what that community is, whether it's a synagogue or whether it's a church, he wants us to have that same dynamic. Now, here it is. Think of his crucifixion. And I put it this way. Yeshua is stretched between the polarities on the execution stake. Can you see him there? He is stretched out, and it's painful, excruciating, extremely difficult, to put it mildly. And there he is, stretched between the polarities. But it doesn't end there. He dies, but is resurrected to a new life and becomes the Bicharon, the first fruits of all who fall asleep in him. I offer this as an analogy. We, in order to solve problems, have to feel both sides of the equation. And that is a difficult place to be, isn't it? Don't we see in our society the political climate as one where people are not willing to embrace both sides of a particular subject, but rather polarize from each other, vilifying the other side, and imagine that that's how we get to truth? I want to tell you, it's not how we get to truth. It's how we get to fighting and misery. But we are called to hold on to both sides of the equation, be stretched out as he was in the complexity of the issue that we face, whatever issue it is, but particularly we're talking about the future of Messianic Judaism, and to feel, on the one hand, the pull that we need to be who we are. On the other hand, we feel the necessity of honoring God's universal call to love all people in Yeshua, and we are stretched there, and it's hard. And it's the part of the job that I have that I dislike more than any, quite frankly, because it's so tough, because we're at that point, that nexus, that point of connection between these two communities, and how do you pull all this together? It's so difficult. But then the good news is we die with him, but we come resurrected to new answers that really work. You see what I'm saying? It's in the complexity, it's in the suffering of the sitting with both sides of the equation where we then allow ourselves to die, in the sense that we will not surrender on either side. We are going to hold on to both, and we're going to figure it out. But then God raises us up to new life and to understandings that we might not have had before. I, today, am not going to resolve anything for us. In the months and years ahead, we will sit in that complexity as a community, and we're going to figure it all out. But I do offer you that as the real solution to many of life's problems, where how easy it is to just grab on one side and vilify the other or ignore the other. No, it's not the Ruach Israel way. I don't think it's Yeshua's way. We join him in his suffering, and we join him in his resurrection. And we trust him that the answers will come. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.